1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Oh my God, Higher Side Chatters, how the hell are you? I am your humble host who calls himself the Carlwood, drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke from sunny San Diego, just trying to take the edge off in these highly tense times. But I am so happy with today's show. People have been asking me to do an episode about Ebola and the medical industry, and I've been listening to what various researchers are saying, and for my money, as ignorant as I am, nobody is more on point with the medical and pharmaceutical arms of the elite's multifaceted population control and murder machine than John Rappaport. I think his perspective is the most logical, and when you have a scare like Ebola or the swine flu, or I get into a conversation about vaccines, I always try to keep John's work in mind. And it's a great show, but John wasn't able to do a full 2 hours, so we're going to call this one a THC special report. And there are still going to be four more full two-hour shows coming out this month, so don't worry about that. This one is extra and extra important. I think there's a lot to be learned here. So I don't see much of a need for me to take up any more time talking. So let's take the trip and dive into the crimes of the CDC, our understanding of disease and medicine, HIV, Ebola, vaccines, and that whole big ball of wax with a truly great investigative journalist, John Rappaport.
When I find myself in times of trouble, Mr. Carlwood comes to me speaking words of wisdom, THC.
People, we know that our reality is warped and tweaked to suit the needs of the nefarious elite, and this well-orchestrated, multifaceted campaign covers almost every aspect of human existence. And right now, we have several major propaganda campaigns, cover-ups, and psyops going on in the medical world, and it's easy to get caught in the snares of misinformation when our understanding of things like health and disease have been shaped to benefit their agenda at a fundamental level for our entire lives. Well, today's guest back for a second appearance is independent investigative journalist John Rappaport, the man behind NoMoreFakeNews.com, and he has dedicated a lot of his time to understanding the underlying manipulations of the medical industry and following the cover-ups and containments of the small glimpses of truth that fall through their tightly wrapped security blanket. And with vaccines, disease, and the CDC so prevalent in today's news cycle, I thought it'd be an opportune time to talk to the guy who's been fighting the good fight against these guys before it was cool, and I can't wait to get down to it from right outside of San Diego. John, my man, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here, Greg.
Yeah, man, it's a real privilege to have you here. I've learned a lot from you on these subjects, and I'm excited to share it with the people and gain some yardage against the medical machine. We have a lot of alternative researchers chalking Ebola up to either an advancement on the population reduction campaign of the elite or strictly an overblown media fear campaign. But you've learned a lot from tracking AIDS and the scary stories of the swine and bird flus. And it seems like before we can really get into Ebola, there's some fundamental things about disease and health and diagnosis that we need to understand. I mean, what have been some of the major revelations for you over the years as you've been investigating these kind of things?
Well, starting in 1987, when I was writing my first book called AIDS, Inc., Scandal of a Century, one of the really shocking things that I came across is one of the simplest things, and that is, how do you decide that somebody has a certain disease? You know, you say, well, this person has HIV, or this person has swine flu, or this person has Ebola. We hear and read from media case numbers, numbers of people who have died. We hear that there's an outbreak, which indicates that, you know, people are sick and dying. And then we're told that there's a reason for this, and it's the so-called, you know, virus, whatever the virus of the moment is. So what it all boils down to is, in order to say that anybody has a particular disease caused by a particular virus, you've got to do a test. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there isn't any other way around it.
Right.
You're not going to say, well, he doesn't look well. or he's got diarrhea, or he's vomiting, or he's got a fever, because those symptoms are so broad and general, including, by the way, bleeding and hemorrhaging, that they could be attributed to dozens of different causes. So you've got to have a test. And this is what most people fail to grasp. If you're not testing, you don't know anything. Mm-hmm. Or suppose that the diagnostic tests that you're doing are unreliable, or worse, useless, or even worse, irrelevant to the matter at hand. Now you're totally in the dark, which means that the people who are heading up the medical operation are writing script. They're making it up. They're pretending they know something when they don't. And so starting back in 1987, I began examining the most frequently done test for HIV, which was a so-called antibody test, of which there were two. One was called the ELISA test, and the other was the so-called gold standard, the Western blot. And they were both searches for antibodies to that specific virus, HIV. And I found so many things wrong with that test at the time. So many false positives, as they would call it. In other words, the test is reacting to things that have nothing to do with HIV. The test is being done in a flawed way by the technicians. And worst of all, the test says nothing about whether or not the person was sick, is sick, or is going to get sick. Says nothing about that whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that's the case with the antibody test. And then after I wrote the book, along came what was supposed to be a much more specific and sophisticated test called the PCR, polymerase chain reaction, which was invented by a resident of San Diego, a biochemist named Carrie Mullis, who won a Nobel Prize for it in 1993. And this test was now being used not only for HIV, but as the phony epidemics rolled along, for every epidemic, including the current one, so-called epidemic of Ebola. And that test has its own shortcomings, to say the least. The major shortcoming is that it says nothing about how much of a given virus is in a person's body, because you need millions and millions of active virus in a person's body to even begin to say that the virus is causing illness or disease or dying. Mm-hmm. The test says nothing about that. In fact, it is also prone to many errors, the first of which is that the tiny, tiny sample of tissue or genetic material taken from the patient is not a piece of a virus at all, but is just simply some cellular debris. And we're talking about such minor amounts of sample size, they're undetectable with the naked eye. And what the PCR test does, it amplifies that tiny sample, it blows it up millions of times so that it can be observed. But if you start off with the wrong item, then everything else that happens after that is going to be totally flawed and irrelevant as well. And then you've got lab errors and so forth, because this is a multi-step, very specific and detailed process. So those are now the two standard tests for Ebola, antibody and PCR. And as I've written in many articles by now at No More Fake News, they are unreliable, useless, and irrelevant. Therefore, and this comes, I know, as a shock to many people who are believers in what medical authorities say, there is absolutely no way to say that anybody on the planet has Ebola, is sick from Ebola, is dying from Ebola, or has died from Ebola, because the only thing that allows you to say that is the diagnostic test. And I would put this close to the top of the biggest medical scandal of the last 100 years.
Wow.
It's not well known. Most people writing about Ebola, no matter what they're saying or which side of the issue they're on, have no idea about what these tests constitute, how irrelevant they are. So they automatically accept the initial assumptions of the medical cartel, which is A, there's a new outbreak of accelerated death in a certain region of the planet, in this case, West Africa, and that the cause of this is something called the Ebola virus. They accept that, and then from that point, they go on to have their various positions about, you know, why this is happening and how it happened and so forth and so on and what the agenda behind it is. But until you get down to this level that I'm talking about now, there is no way to have a clue about what is really going on and how deceptive the whole game actually is.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, that this being the first line of defense and the first area of manipulation, I mean, everything that comes after is kind of a moot point. But obviously the makers of these tests know that they're ineffective, whether it's by design or just inconvenience is, I guess, up to for debate. But how much of the medical community knows this information? Are doctors and nurses kind of ignorant? Are they just accepting the tests from the higher up and then just going with, you know, red or green, positive or negative?
Yes, they're accepting. The vast majority of people in the medical profession simply accept that the tests are reliable, they're good and useful. There is a small number of people in the medical professions, in the medical research professions, who have questioned the tests. But as has been pointed out to me by several people, there's a process of selection here. In other words, if you happen to be one of the medical professionals who question or doubt the veracity of the tests, you don't get to publish in the journals. You don't get to have grant money. You don't get to do studies. You don't get to do a reanalysis of the tests by other means that are more direct and correct.
Right.
You're not part of the game anymore, you see. And in fact, if you begin to make noise about this, then if you have a job, you can lose it. If you have grant money, you can lose it. You can be exiled outside the community. So there are very real dangers, and medical professionals and research people understand this. So it looks like there are only a very few people who doubt the central reality that's being given to us, you know, from the top of the control ladder. But in fact, there are more, except they're just remaining quiet.
Right. I wanted to hop back to AIDS for a little bit, because I know you did do a lot of research into it, and I'm still kind of confused about it a little bit. I think it left a lot of people with a lot of questions. It just sort of drifted in the background after its huge explosion. And what really happened there?
Well, you know, I covered that in about 320 pages in my book, so boiling it down is a little bit difficult, but here's the way my research proceeded back in 1987. I knew there was something wrong with the story, the narrative, but I couldn't put my finger on it, and it was my first time out as an investigator into medical issues. And I had a lot of help, a lot of input from researchers, but what I was looking at was immune suppression. The destruction of the immune system was said to be the hallmark of AIDS and HIV. And then the person would die from some sort of an infection from a germ that would ordinarily be completely harmless, except that his immune system was so weakened that he couldn't fight off that infection, and so it just blossomed and he died.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the mantra. So in the spring of, spring, summer of 1987, I was alerted by a publisher that there was a paper in a journal, a recognized journal, that questioned HIV as the cause of AIDS. Up to that point, I had bought the assumption just like everybody else. And I read the paper, I interviewed the researcher extensively. I interviewed other researchers who were very angry about the appearance of this research paper. And I applied simple logic to what they were saying on all sides of the issue. And I came up with the conclusion that there was very serious reason to doubt that what was being called AIDS was caused by this virus called HIV. So here's the tack that I took. I said, okay, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, claims that there are several so-called high-risk groups for AIDS. Africans, Haitians, blood transfusion recipients, hemophiliacs, gay men. All right, so suppose I were to go into those, quote, communities and do research and see if there were reasons why the immune systems of these people were collapsing that had nothing to do with the virus, HIV or any other virus.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that the story might be much simpler than we've been led to believe. And lo and behold, that's exactly what I found. The reasons for immune system collapse in these different groups were different, but they all led to that same basic endpoint: no immune system, therefore no ability to fight off any kind of germ or toxic element. Therefore, dying death. And so I spent a great deal of time in the book AIDS, Inc. laying out this case. For example, I found considerable research that the biggest cause of so-called T-cell depletion in the world is malnutrition. And T-cells are a vital component of the immune system. In fact, for some time, researchers had been saying that HIV was infecting and destroying T cells, and that's why immune systems failed. But when I started to look into malnutrition in Africa, I discovered many research papers and much information in the literature that indicated that, you know, large numbers of people were dying because their immune systems were destroyed because they were starving to death, or they were severely malnourished, or they weren't getting enough protein, and that you didn't really need any kind of a virus to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one illustration out of many of non-viral factors that were killing people. In gay men in New York and San Francisco, it was something entirely different. In hemophiliac patients, it was something entirely different. Many different factors. And after that, I went back to HIV and I said, well, what proof do we have that HIV causes immune suppression? So I began to look at the original research by Robert Gallo. And one of the hallmarks of research is that you take people who have been diagnosed with a certain disease, and you look for a common virus that is present in all of these people. And by the methods of medical research, you should be able to find it and extract it from everybody that's labeled with that specific disease. Well, in the case of Gallo, you were looking at between maybe, 30 to 60% of the people that he used as volunteers, maybe. Well, that was a big shocker, because based on that, there was no proof to say that HIV caused AIDS. You would reject it out of hand, but he didn't. And he was the primary moving force for the announcement of HIV as the cause of AIDS. And then I found many other anomalies operating in his research and his lab. For example, his claim that he isolated HIV himself when it was obvious that he was simply using a specimen from the Pasteur Institute in Paris that had been given to him under the pretext that he was going to, you know, do further research on it or so forth. But he basically committed a criminal act by simply lifting that virus specimen and using it to claim that he had proved that HIV caused AIDS. In other words, this guy began to appear as a criminal figure rather than an honest researcher.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the research. And then on top of it, people who were diagnosed as being HIV positive were being given a drug called AZT, which had been released for public use based on a completely fraudulent human study of, efficacy.
Mm-hmm.
And this drug was a chemotherapy drug that had been put on the shelf at the National Institutes of Health in around 1960 because they had tried it on rats with leukemia and it was a failure. And all of a sudden, for, you know, some unknown reason, they resurrected it. And now they were giving it to everybody who was being diagnosed as HIV positive and not being given like chemotherapy is given, where because the drugs are so highly toxic, you say, okay, you're going to get a round of chemotherapy and then we wait and we give you another round. No, this was being given to patients at high dose every day for the rest of their lives.
Hmm.
Well, this drug attacks all cells of the body and keeps them from reproducing as chemo drugs do. And it has a particular affinity for destroying cells of the immune system, which is supposed to be characteristic of what HIV is doing.
Right.
Right. So now we were into murder. Murder. We couldn't characterize it any other way.
True.
Anyway, these are just some of the elements that I uncovered, and there are many more in the complete hoax called AIDS. So when, you know, other so-called epidemics came down the pipeline, West Nile, bird flu, SARS, swine flu, Ebola, I began to apply the same research methods to these, and I found the same situations, the same pattern of research that I did with HIV paid off with all of these other so-called epidemics.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's so much ignorance about science and the science of disease. It's obviously a key component, and there's so much damage to be done. So I know people are anxious to hear about Ebola, but you have to go and do the groundwork because there's so many fundamental things about disease, so many misconceptions that you can't talk about it without going back to square one.
Yeah, that's the thing, you see. And that's what I keep emphasizing in my articles about Ebola. Go back to the basic assumptions here. Question everything. Because as you remarked earlier, if you begin to accept the basic assumptions, you're cooked. Because then you're right on the track that they want you on. And you're going to follow along. Yes, you may have disagreements. Yes, you may say they're lying about this. They should have done that. The CDC is crazy. Bah, 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 bah. But if you never get back to the basic assumptions, you're never going to see the real picture. And that is a major, major problem.
So do you see this? I mean, obviously, most of the elites' campaigns are multifaceted. but are we seeing a situation where the companies that are making the tests and the treatments are the same company? I mean, what is the motivation behind getting the numbers so high, knowing that they're false positives?
I wrote an article the other day called Ebola, Who Benefits? 30 Answers.
Right, that's a great
piece. This is a multi-level, operation. There are many payoffs at many different levels. But yes, the testing companies that make the diagnostic tests and the vaccine manufacturers and the drug manufacturers, et cetera, they all live in the same basic world. They all know that they're feeding each other. So there are no cop-outs. Nobody defects. Nobody suddenly says, hey, these tests are useless. Wait a minute, the vaccine manufacturer says, everything that we're doing to develop a vaccine is based on the tests. That never happens. So there's a community of interest there, you bet. But, you know, then you've got other motivations behind this. For example, the West African countries of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone are vast, rich sources of natural resources, diamonds, oil, gold, you know, whatever, etc., and farmland. So the idea of weakening and depopulating the people of those countries through other means that have nothing to do with the virus has been an ongoing campaign for a very long time, because the whole point is to take over the resources of those countries, talking about outside financiers, mega corporations like mining corporations and so forth, to just totally rape and pillage the country. Well, if you're going to do that, as we've seen in Nigeria, for example, with oil, you're going to get resistance from the population. So the weaker you can make the population, the more poor you can keep them, the more war you can foment between different sectors, the more starvation that you can bring, the more industrial pollution that destroys bodies, the more toxic pesticides you can introduce. And I've covered all this in great detail in my articles. You've now got an ongoing chronic situation which is benefiting the big heavy hitters who want to take over these countries. And then in addition, you seal off the borders and you bring in military troops from the U.S. and other countries. Well, I mean, that's transparent. But if you look at it from that angle, you now see that the virus, the Ebola virus, is a fantastically good cover story for all of this. Mm-hmm. Because everybody throws up his hands and says, well, we don't know what's going on. It's Ebola. We just leave it to the medical people. All this death and dying, we don't know from that. We never did. You know, all of a sudden, and they did the same with HIV. Oh, my God, HIV. Never heard of it. Wow, that's why everybody's dying. Ebola, oh, that's why everybody's dying. These are cover stories. People have to look at these so-called epidemics as intelligence ops. They are like intelligence agency operations. And every intelligence agency operation needs to have a great cover story, which is a diversion away from what is actually going on. And what is actually going on in these countries is the destruction of the population through these factors that I briefly mentioned here, which has been going on forever.
Right.
But they need cover stories. They can't just say, yeah, we're killing the people. They can't just say, look, we know that we could bring in any number, one of, let's say, 5,000 companies tomorrow, and they would clean up the contaminated water supplies of our country in 6 months, thereby eliminating a huge amount of death and dying. They can't say that, but, you know, people begin to wonder about this. You know, how come they're not cleaning up the water? anybody can do that. Yeah. Maybe they're keeping the water contaminated on purpose. Yeah, why would they want to, you know? And then now the operation is in danger. It could be exposed. You start pulling on that string for a while and you begin to see other things. So they always need a cover story. Mm-hmm. Well, the invisible killer virus that nobody could see and it can attack anybody anywhere at any time. Fantastic.
Yeah, better than terrorism.
Absolutely, much better. And then on top of that, you see, in order to cement down the cover story, you've got to have international patients. You can't just put it in West Africa. Oh, we got a guy in Dallas. Oh, we got a nurse in Maine. Oh, we got this doctor in New York. Oh, we got somebody in Spain. Oh, it's getting out. Oh, this, that. Oh, you see, now the fear factor is raised considerably. The scare propaganda, the media get on this, and it becomes a bonanza of hysteria.
Right.
That convinces yet more people that the whole thing is real to begin with, that we've got a viral outbreak here. Because now people feel like, well, you know, maybe I should stay in the house if I live in New York. Maybe I shouldn't walk on the streets. Maybe the editor of my newspaper who was in Liberia, maybe I should stay away from him at work. You know, all this insanity. And then you get pictures in the news of people in hazmat suits in New York. And, you know, all of a sudden, now you're really cooking with the cover story. Now people are just, you know, they would never turn around and say, hey, this whole thing is fake. The virus, we don't even know if anybody's sick from the virus. You need those international patients to cement down the cover story, and that's exactly what we're getting.
Yeah, that's making a lot of sense. So let's go deep into the storyline of Ebola. I mean, it's been the media's main topic for some time now, but take a little bit of time to walk us through this specific saga. I mean, what do people really need to know about the way this specific case has unfolded?
Okay, start off with the word outbreak. You see, they use terms, words, images that resonate with people, that bring up fear in people, that bring up in people other images, other emotions, other ideas, other beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is media propaganda. It sells newspapers, but it also helps to push forward the agenda behind this whole thing. So start with the word outbreak. What does that mean to people? Oh, well, all of a sudden people are dying that weren't dying before.
Right.
And outbreak means contagion. It's spreading. It's infectious. It's transmissible. It must be a germ. All of that is included in the idea of outbreak. See?
Right. Busting through the wall like the Kool-Aid man.
Exactly. So that's where you begin. And then, of course, on top of that, the experts come along and they say, we know why we have the outbreak. It's a germ. And everybody goes, oh, yeah, well, I mean, that's what an outbreak is, right? We've seen all the movies. Okay, so what is it? It's a virus. Oh, yeah, okay. What virus? Ebola. Okay, sold. That's where it all starts in the media. And from that point on, what the media is doing is simply taking all of their stories from the press offices at the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. Now it's a done deal. How many people are dying? Okay, 900 next week, 1,500 next week, 3,000. How many cases? 6,000, 8,000, you know. We provide, the CDC is just, you know, pumping all this out. Newspapers are picking it up. How is it transmitted? Okay, so the CDC, now there's a big debate. Okay, is it, can you get it in the air? Can you get it in the water? Can you get it, you know, by brushing up against somebody, this, that, and the other thing? But that's all part of the hype and the scare, because now you create uncertainty about, ooh, the deadly terrorist, how can I suddenly die because I'm attacked by the terrorist. I don't know. What do I do? I'm not sure. And the fear is built up step by step, brick by brick, until the people are so hooked on the story, just like reading a novel or like watching a series on TV. Everybody's aching to find out the next episode. Will the doctor in New York die in the hospital? Why did the nurse take a bike ride? Will the governor of Maine have her arrested and quarantined with cops guarding her house?
All right, Johnny.
On and on this goes, you see. And at that point, no more basic groundwork has to be done. The media carried this like a weekly TV series like CSI or Scandal or whatever. Everybody wants to know the next episode. And it's a done deal.
Yeah, man, I am with you. And one aspect that I think is most interesting about this case, opposed to the situations in the past, is the quarantine drama. I don't remember nearly as much focus on this aspect of any of the other disease scares of the last 30 years, but now there's so much emphasis on the drama of the quarantine versus civil liberties. And the media has done a great job of turning the public against these people, leading the public to believe that they're a threat, which is the same story, same thing they tried to do with terrorists, but most of us are a little more wise to that game. But this is the same story. We had this huge public outcry over indefinite detention. The government can now lock up anybody without charge, even Americans, and everybody's upset about it, but they're doing this right now to people. You say somebody's got Ebola, and you have the public's full support to lock them up for as long as you need, because they bought the lie, just like the Boston bombing. They issued a police state there, citywide lockdown over two suspects, and then we see the citizens clapping and cheering and waving the flags for this behavior, and the elite have to be loving it, because this really is a bit of a sweet spot for them.
You bet. And that's why you've got all this issue of arguing back and forth about quarantine, because it's to raise public sentiment. All of a sudden, this nurse, who, by the way, works for the CDC as an epidemic intelligence officer, which is the sort of intelligence wing of the CDC.
Might she be like a crisis actor?
Yeah, in a sense, she is, and maybe actually is. Maybe this whole thing is a put-up job, but either way, her refusal to be quarantined exacerbates the public sentiment on the side of quarantine. And so you brought up the issue of civil liberties. And again, this is a big element of the Ebola operation. We want to be able to quarantine American citizens, and we want to gain acceptance for this. We're not quarantining the entire city of New York, but we're moving in that direction, step by step. Mm-hmm. Because once we can do that, we can now set the stage for more extensive quarantines. And also, we can mandate the vaccine whenever it is released. We can say, all right, all health workers in the state of Maine and in New York City and in Dallas and here and there and whatever have to get the vaccine. Otherwise, they're fired. Well, if you've been following the flu story, you know that this is already rampant among nurses.
True.
Some of whom have refused the vaccine and they've been fired. So with the Ebola vaccine, I mean, this is going to be much more heavy. She refused to take the vaccine, and she's working around Ebola patients and is now possibly a carrier. Well, we got to fire her and quarantine her. I mean,
right.
This is heavy stuff. And then the vaccine, as more becomes available, is now mandated for all of the contacts of the Dallas Ebola patient, all of the contacts of Craig Spencer, the doctor in New York City who's in Bellevue Hospital, and, you know, begins to spread. Okay, now we want to vaccinate everybody who lives in the following neighborhood in New York City. Now we're really getting down to it. Door-to-door searches. And if you refuse, we arrest you. And you are now quarantined for 21 days, 42 days, whatever it is.
Right.
It's moving in that direction.
It is.
And what is that all about? That's about control of the population. It's about the elimination of the Bill of Rights, the right to assembly. Okay, so now in Midtown Manhattan, we're going to say that all concerts are canceled. Well, that's the right of assembly. Okay, well, what about the political event scheduled for the such and such hotel? Nope, can't do that either.
Right.
Why? The virus. And as I extensively articulated in AIDS, Inc., medical operations are the most successful political operations because they don't appear to be political at all. They're totally neutral, nonpartisan. We're doing this for you. We care. We're saving humanity. This has nothing to do with politics, blah, 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 blah. And that is why, to me, in the long term, the medical cartel is the most dangerous cartel on the planet.
Agreed. Yeah, they get a total pass. And when your guard is down, that's when you're the most susceptible. And that's what we're seeing here. And I guess the most common thread that I'm hearing in the conspiracy community of alternative researchers is they're generally saying that the Africans are telling them that there was nobody sick before the Red Cross started to show up. And from that, people are deducing that, oh, well, the Red Cross and the CDC and the people who are going out there are actually infecting them with Ebola. But I mean, it seems here that there just might not be any Ebola at all. They're just picking up sick people and just labeling them that way. Kind of like we saw a lot of people think Sandy Hook, there was no shooting, that it was all just for the cameras. I mean, it seems to be the same way here. I mean, is there just no Ebola outbreak at all?
Well, until somebody can show me that they're doing a diagnostic test that makes any sense on people, the burden of proof is on them. It's not on me or you.
Right.
You're going to tell me that people are dying and that the world is in an uproar because of this, that, and the other thing? Prove it. Otherwise, get out of my way. Now, as far as vaccine campaigns in the third world, I covered that in AIDS, Inc., and I've continued to write about it over the years. First of all, these campaigns, as they're constituted, without any special changes, are inherently toxic. Why? Because every vaccine contains toxic chemicals that are injected into the body, like formaldehyde and like polysorbate 80. And then we've got heavy metals like mercury and aluminum. I mean, these are incredibly toxic things, and they're injected into the body directly. And then on top of that, you've got germs. The germ that's supposed to be in the virus, I mean, in the vaccine, and then other passenger germs that get into vials of the vaccine because there are germs everywhere, including in laboratories that make vaccines. And we've had numerous scandals about that over the years. So if people believe that these labs are pristine and pure and the facilities that manufacture are pristine, you know, they should rethink that. It's not true. And all of this, it's not being sort of exposed in an indirect way. It's being injected into the body, which means it bypasses a number of normal channels of the immune system. And some of these elements cross the blood-brain barrier, like the heavy metals, and cause irreparable damage. So take that, okay? Take, let's say, five major vaccine campaigns in a country like Liberia, where you already have a population whose immune systems are on the edge of collapsing and already have collapsed. Now, on top of that, you're going to inject these people with five different vaccines. Well, it's called murder. Right. Now, on top of that, and I'm not ruling this out, it's very easy to include in a vaccine some special thing, some mm-hmm. other toxic element on top of all that toxicity, which will render people even more helpless and will create more death and dying. Very easy to do. You don't have to have vials of virus that, you know, you walk around and you just kind of release. You just do vaccines. Yes, right. The World Health Organization, in order to save humanity in Africa, is a new yellow fever vaccine campaign. And we have, 300 billion dollars to promote the campaign to people. Forget the actual campaign, right? To explain why it's such a great idea, and blah blah blah, and everybody should get behind it. And we're collaborating with the medical system of Liberia and the government, and blah blah blah. You know, and you get these celebrities behind all this. These celebrities who know absolutely zero about any of this, right?
Right.
But who want to be thought of as, saviors and prophets and messiahs and whatever. So they do this. I mean, the medical, I'll just give you an example. And I wrote about this the other day. July 26, 2000, Journal of the American Medical Association, a review called "Is U.S. Health Really the Best in the World?" written by Dr. Barbara Starfield, who at the time was a revered public health expert at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. So this was a mainstream review. Everybody's credentials were meticulous. You would think, therefore, it would become a major media story, because what Starfield concluded was, every year in the U.S., the medical system directly kills 225,000 people. That's 2.25 million people per decade, like clockwork. And the reason I bring this up is to illustrate that modern medicine, which is really pharmaceutical medicine, which, if you track it back to its source, is really Rockefeller medicine, is incredibly toxic. On the face of it, without having to get into exotic explanations and bioengineered weapons and so forth. I'm not trying to say that nobody should do that research. I'm just saying you don't need it in order to explain the killing factor of modern medicine.
Right.
So that story was covered in the press briefly in 2000. And then it disappeared. And I interviewed Dr. Starfield in 2009. And one of the questions that I asked her was, since you published that paper, has any element of the government approached you to help in fixing the situation? No, she said. And I said, to your knowledge, has the government undertaken any remedial effort to reverse this horrendous situation? No. In fact, if you go to an FDA website page called Why Learn About Adverse Drug Reactions, you will see that the FDA itself says that every year in the U.S., 100,000 people die as a result of ingesting medical drugs. And this is that's a million people per decade. And this is the agency that is tasked, the only agency, with certifying drugs as safe and effective before they're released for public use. And yet they're taking no responsibility for it. So what we're looking at here is a holocaust of enormous proportions. And in order to keep this system going, and not only keep it going, but to promote it as valuable, beneficial, even heroic. The people behind that system need epidemics. These are highlights for them to keep on promoting the, quote, heroic aspects of modern medicine. And the doctors are going to West Africa even though they could die, and they're doing this and that, and they're coming back, and they're in isolation wards, and it's wonderful, and the doctors are getting off the planes here in Sierra Leone, you know, all of this total bullshit promotion of modern medicine, when in fact, what Africa needs is nutritious food, clean up the water supplies, return the stolen farmland, stolen by corporations in collusion with dictators, to the people so they can grow their own food and eat it. Let people resettle out into the country to eliminate the horrendous overcrowding in the cities, which is always a breeding ground for disease when you have no basic sanitation. Restore basic sanitation to these countries. Eliminate the toxic vaccine campaigns and the toxic medical drugs. And these countries will recover. But that's not in the cards, for the reasons I explained. So instead, what we're seeing is the only thing that can save Africa is doctors. That is total horseshit. That is the reverse of what's needed. This is not a medical problem. And in fact, if you read actual histories of the decline of infectious disease in the West, what you see is that these basic factors that I've just mentioned are the reason for the decline. Nothing medical, not the vaccines, not the medical drugs. The decline began long before the widespread use of vaccines or the introduction of antibiotics. Improve the nutrition, the rise of the middle class. Get the, you know, the sewers off of the streets, so that you don't have feces floating in the streets. Clean up the cities.
Yeah.
Better food, nutrition. Magically, disease disappears. The medical cartel must conceal this fact.
Right, or they're all out of a job.
Exactly.
This is just so enlightening, because commonly people ask about Ebola and like what's going on, and everyone thinks this is part of a depopulation campaign by the elite, that it's finally happening, that the Georgia Guidestones have been updated, and now, you know, we're in the final moments. But what never made sense about that to me is, like, you know, the elite have themselves and their families to care about. You can't just release a serious virus, because how do you contain it? And I thought, well, you know, maybe the elite have some high-end clean vaccine so they don't have to worry about it. But this makes it much more simple. You know, this is it's just a PR game, really, and the elite aren't in any danger. They don't have to worry about, oh, am I going to get, is this Ebola thing going to get way too out of control, because there is no Ebola thing. So it's so much easier to maintain. This is so enlightening.
Yeah, it's so much easier to maintain a fake than to try to deal with, you know, quote, the real thing. No question about it. See, you don't need any of that. You don't need any of that. And by the way, the whole preposterous idea that, you know, there are these magic antidotes is total nonsense. Because how disease develops in the body, the actual process by which it occurs, which has everything to do with the immune system, there are no magic bullets that you can give people that just, you know, knock out a virus. That's just, you know, sheer fiction that you see in movies. Oh, well, you know, but now we have the antidote was flown in at the last minute, and we injected her with it, and lo and behold, she's recovered. Right. Absolute nonsense. You know, so, yes.
And putting it in those movies, that also affects the way the public perceives it.
Oh, big time. Big time. Big time. They love that. Started off with Michael Crichton, you could say, the, you know, the modern recent version, the Andromeda strain, which was, you know, in the for a popular movie, very well done. because they kept pressing you up against the researchers in the labs and the people who really knew what was going on, and they couldn't stop it, and, you know, all that. And then the spate of movies that came after that. And then this nonsensical book, The Hot Zone. And then you had NPR and PBS chiming in with their, which most people don't even remember now. But basically, the theme was, if you want to take it to its extreme, we have to destroy modern civilization, right? Because modern civilization gives us modern communication and modern travel, and therefore these diseases will keep on coming out of the deep, dark jungle and will be unstoppable. So this plugs into the radical, you know, environmental agenda. And when I say radical, you can underline that 75,000 times, which is modern civilization needs to be destroyed.
Right.
So that we can depopulate the planet, take it back to, you know, whatever, 500 million people or less. And we have the very, you know, top of the line elite people living like kings and queens, and everybody else is like living at the bottom of the hill in feudal times, you know, bring all that back. Of course, we do have technology, but that's all underground, and it's, and we don't have anything unsightly above ground. Everything looks like a country club and it's wonderful. You know, we're talking about that. That was a big PR push when the first Ebola thing was promoted back in the mid to late 70s. And now it's back again. So there are all these threads that, you know, are feeding into it. And these are the agendas that are behind all this.
Yeah, it all just makes so much more sense to me now. And another thing I wanted to talk about is the CDC and this saga you've been following and chronologizing through your site of the whistleblower who exposed a cover-up of a link between the MRR vaccine and autism. And it's very important because this calls into question the credibility of the CDC, which is an organization that's very heavily involved in Ebola. And if they can't be trusted on one hand, why should they be trusted on the other? So can you kind of tell us what happened there with that saga?
Sure. First of all, I've been documenting for years the incredible, I mean, staggering lies of the CDC on any number of subjects that have to do with germs and vaccines and all sorts of things. So, yes, unreliable, to say the least. William Thompson is a research scientist at the CDC. He's been working there for 15 years, an insider. Co-authored a 2004 study that was published in a very prestigious journal called Pediatrics that looked at a potential connection between the MMR vaccine and autism, measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. He became remorseful, ridden with guilt, anguished in the years following the publication 2004, because he knew that he and his co-authors had cooked the data, buried vital data, to come to the conclusion that the vaccine had no connection to autism. He knew this, chapter and verse. He began to confess to a couple of people, perhaps, I think, texting and by phone, certainly by phone. Andrew Wakefield, Brian Hooker. Some of those phone calls were recorded. And Thompson eventually claimed that he didn't know that and he never gave his permission. I have my doubts about that, but whatever. Anyway, eventually it became apparent this August that this anonymous whistleblower on the phone who was confessing his sins was William Thompson. And through his attorney, Rick Morgan, a very well-known whistleblower lawyer in Cincinnati, on August 27th, Thompson released a public statement saying, if you just read the text, we lied. We omitted vital data. We changed the protocol of the study that had to do with a connection between the MMR vaccine and autism. Well, to put it in a nutshell, because we only have a few minutes here, what Thompson basically was saying is, I'm not just a guy who came in from the outside criticizing a study. I'm one of the authors of the study. I'm an insider at the CDC, and he still works there even today. And I'm telling you, fraud. Not only that, but in these phone calls, Thompson has also admitted to fraud, or not fraud, has stated unequivocally that there is a connection between mercury and vaccines and autism, which the U.S. government has denied over and over and over again. I mean, this is major stuff. So what do we see? A total media blackout. I mean, this is an explosive story. Even because you've got somebody on the inside who is an author admitting fraud, research fraud. I have never heard of such a thing in all my years of covering medical issues, which is now 30 years, pretty much.
Right.
Never an author, not accused, nothing, just comes out and says, I did it. We all did it. And our bosses told us to do it. At the CDC, right?
Right.
So how many kids have been dying because they've been taking incurring brain damage because they've been taking these vaccines since 2004, when Thompson could have gone public?
Right.
In fact, in 2004, and I can wrap it up with this because this is really the cherry on the cake, around the time that this phony study was going to be published, Thompson was also due to make a live presentation at a major vaccine autism conference, CDC conference, where apparently there were also going to be members of the public permitted to attend. Thompson was nervous, paranoid to the extreme at the prospect of facing hostile mothers of autistic children. He wrote a letter to the head of the CDC, bypassing his own bosses. At the time, the head of the CDC was Julie Gerberding. And he said, look, I am about to present troubling data on the relationship between the MMR vaccine and autism at this conference. I want to give you a heads up. You've got to do something about this. I don't know what, you know, we need help here. So, you know, this is a dangerous situation. Never got an answer, and he never did make a presentation at the conference. Julie Gerberding, the head of the CDC, went on, head of the CDC, until 2009 when she left, and became the president of Merck Vaccines, which manufactures the MMR vaccine.
Boom.
The very subject of the fraudulent study in 2004. Now, if that ain't a major media explosive story, I don't know what is. And if you covered that the way you're supposed to, by pounding on a scandal day after day and week after week, so many rats would come out of the closet confessing their sins, eventually under pressure. Yeah, I knew about it. Yeah, okay, all right, I knew about it. And you know who else knew about it? You know, you would have just, I mean, incredible.
Right,
but
right.
You got a media blackout on this, total media blackout.
Gosh.
So reliable, the CDC? Man, they are basically a PR agency for vaccines who claims also to be doing scientific research on vaccines. Those two stances are incompatible. And so naturally you would expect fraud, because the PR function is the major function. The CDC sets the schedule of vaccines for children in the U.S. They promote the value of vaccines. They do heavy PR telling people to get vaccines. So that's what they are.
Right. And man, it's a fascinating story. And the only other points, I know we're running out of time, that I wanted to hit on that is that this Merck Vaccines company, they also make the Gardasil cervical cancer vaccine, which another whistleblower has tried to expose. So now we're looking at two vaccines from the same company. The head of the CDC now is the president of this company. They're like the Monsanto of the, you know, pharmaceuticals. Monsanto's working on the GMO weakening side of things, and then this Merck vaccine company seems to be running parallel with them on the medical side.
You bet. That's a good epithet for them. They are the Monsanto of the pharmaceutical industry. They and Glaxo. And all you have to do is, I mean, just look up, this is just surface stuff, okay? But if you just go to a search engine and you look up Merck and Glaxo and the fines they've had to pay out for lying and cheating and scamming and so forth, and that's just, you know, chump change to them.
Right.
That's just the surface. What they're really doing is what we're talking about here.
And to wrap it up with a final point and bring it back to the last interview we did, which was right when Snowden started coming out and we started hearing about him, and you were very skeptical of Snowden and the whole story. Well, now we've been talking about whistleblowers who are talking about real serious medical concerns, and we're hit with a media blackout, and you and I were both saying we were very skeptical of Snowden because we know how controlled the mass media is, and if they're willing to talk about it on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News 24/7, then there's something not right about that story. And so here we see the contrast between real whistleblowers who are talking about serious health concerns and the nefarious agendas of the elite versus a guy who's just telling us that they're monitoring us, which is something that most of us assumed was happening already. You know, if that was legitimate, he probably would be victim of a media blackout or a killing like some of these other people, Andrew Breitbart or Michael Hastings. And that's kind of where you should look when you're trying to decide what's real and what isn't.
Yeah. It's a major tip-off, you know, that a scandal of this proportion is getting absolutely no media coverage. I mean, like I say, I've been in the game for 30 years now, so I know what makes a potential killer story. Mm-hmm. And I know how it can be covered and exploited and expanded on. And I know how many newspapers and can be sold and how many hits can be obtained on websites for major media when they do cover a story of this proportions. But you see, they don't care about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the New York Times and other newspapers are going broke. They're in so much red ink that they're refinancing the red ink they're already in. And if you look at their, like this, the LA Times Sunday edition, which I used to occasionally buy, and I could hardly carry it to the car. And now, you know, I can practically slip it in my pocket. It's so thin. They're just, you know, a story like this, you would think, wow, we could save our whole operation on this basis. We could pound on this for 2 years.
Right.
But they don't. Mm-hmm. That tells you something. This whole thing is a vast cover-up.
It is, man. Well, John, this has been highly educational. I'm so glad you could come and take the time to drop some knowledge on us. And before we get out of here, would you like to tell the people about your website or some of the other work you have out there?
Yeah. NoMoreFakeNews.com is the website. And I have three major collections, Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. People can read all about what these are. It's basically a deeper approach to all of this. It's saying, okay, look, reality is being invented for us. And not just little reality, big reality, everywhere reality. How is it being done? What are the nuts and bolts of how it's being done? What does it look like when you see it in the process of it being done, right? Mm-hmm. To understand that at such a deep level. And then in the next two collections, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. This is now, okay, so how do you create your reality? What is that all about? What is that process? How much power can you access in doing that?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? There are many exercises and techniques that are in these collections. And of course, the bottom line is, how can you create reality in such a way that it begins to tip the seesaw in the other direction so that more people become aware that reality is being created for them all the time?
Right.
Because that is what the major, major operation on planet Earth really is and always has been. And so I take it to that level. Meanwhile, by going to No More Fake News, you can read my articles, which I write almost every day, and sign up for free emails and so forth.
Awesome, man. Well, thanks again. You know, keep doing what you do. You're great at it. It's an uphill battle, and you're doing such a great job of shining the light on this serious dark spot. I know I appreciate it. Hopefully you can keep us abreast of any developments, and we'll talk again as things unfold. But until then, take care of yourself, man.
Okay, Greg. Thanks so much. I really enjoyed this conversation. I appreciate it.
Me too. All right. Have a good one.
You too, man.
Well, whoop, there it is, people. A well-researched, well-articulated response to the Ebola hysteria. I know this whole area is just a massive knot of lies and manipulation, and it's a real pain in the ass to unravel it all. We're also concerned about our health and who to trust, but we've caught these people in lies, so we know we can't trust them. Unfortunately, they're the only option, the only ruling authority in Western medicine. And they don't seem to be on our side. I've got friends in the medical industry who get really heated and sensitive about these issues because from their perspective, they've had all these years of study and training, and then it's a real headache to get into a vaccine debate with the ignorant masses who, from their perspective, are putting the greater society at risk by not vaccinating. But they don't consider the source of all they know about medicine. They don't take into account that our educational institutions and medical industries are funded by super greedy society-shaping elite, and they don't do it for the enlightenment of man. They do it to control information, control entire industries, fields, and schools of thought. So I'm sorry, I can't trust that education, and I can't trust doctors who have been indoctrinated by it. Call me paranoid, but there was a time when doctors told everyone that cigarettes were actually good for you, because these doctors are only facades of educated and trustworthy medical experts, and they are for sale to the highest bidder. And admittedly, I don't know a lot about disease or medicines or vaccines, but I know how to sniff out corruption and deceit, and there's enough of it in the world of modern medicine for me to just wash my hands of the whole damn thing and say, you know what, guys, thanks, but I'm gonna take my chances with sweet Mother Nature for as long as I can. Keep your Rockefeller medicine. And I'll see you next week with a full two-hour show talking about geomancy and the alignment of various man-made structures throughout history with a true champion of that field, Kort Lindahl. Stay healthy, my friends. Hold my hand, it's shaking bad. I'm going to the doctor. I pay him, he'll fix me up. I think I got enough, but no. Ambulance don't cost too much. We'll take a van. If they can't fix me, no one can. If they can't fix it, no one can. Want you to take me to the H, take me to the O, want you to take me to the S, take me to the E, want you to take me to the I, T, A, L, want you to take me to the hospital. My face bounced, my cheek on the